When we set out at the beginning of the year to look at this series of Bible stories, I worked with Megan Gleason to pull together a few colorful and particularly evocative stories out of the many, many possible ones that were present in the Hebrew and New Testament scriptures. And the Tower of Babel made the final cut. But as so often the case with preaching subjects, it's not until I get close to it and not until it comes time to really delve into it that I realize that I have to grapple with how difficult and problematic and ambiguous a topic it is. And I certainly have that experienced here. So this morning I'm going to explore a few things. First, just a little bit about why we chose the story. Second, what are some of the interpretive challenges and how can they be addressed? And third, what might the story have to say to us as a simple teaching story? If we don't overanalyze it and take it too heavily, we can see it as a parable of broken relations that seem to forever ask for an answer, a response to our predicament. So what does Unitarian Universalist practice have to say to the Tower of Babel? So why consider this story? Well, in short, it's one of the great iconic symbols embedded in Western art and culture that continues to have resonance. The mythic image of the Tower of Babel has always struck me as fantastic and dramatic, and as an icon of the human drive for immortal greatness, and also an icon or a symbol of human folly. And as the unfinished tower falls into ruin, it stands, at least in the collective mythic imagination, as a tragic monument to the breakdown of human relations. It's been portrayed again and again in art, in Western art. It's a favorite motif for painters. Some of the anonymous artisans of the Middle Ages expressed it, as did the late Renaissance painters. Gustave Doré etched it in the 19th century. And the contemporary artist Mark Escher did his own surreal take on the tower's convoluted architecture. Painters, sculptors, and architects are still inspired today by the story's layered meanings. For example, one of the buildings of the European Parliament in Strasbourg, France, the Louis Weiss Building, includes a tower that appears to be unfinished, and it was intentionally designed to evoke, in modern architecture, the Tower of Babel, depicted in the brilliant painting by Peter Bruegel, painted in 1563. So as with all symbols, the meaning of this design choice for the EU building is multi-layered. It symbolizes the original possibility of human cooperation, as well as the drive for greatness described in the story. It calls to restore what was broken. Even if humanity has become fragmented into many languages and cultures, can we peacefully collaborate and become united once again? Some see a more sinister or at least a more disturbing intention in the building and in the European Union itself. Hubris, vainglory, the urge for domination, the defiance of God. The willful drive to resurrect and repeat a mythic undertaking that was doomed in the first place and is still doomed today. And I think all of this ambiguity points to one of the central dilemmas or tensions in the story. Was the tragic flaw in the hubris of humanity for trying to build the tower? Or was the tragic flaw in the character of God, who destroys the unity of man because he is threatened by human potential? Both elements are present, and we'll look into that a little more in a moment. The story of the Tower of Babel is ancient. Bible scholars believe its author could be from as early as 700 BCE, and yet the obviously anthropomorphic God in the story and other elements carry the resonance of even earlier Semitic traditions. The Sumerian story of En-Merkar and the Lord of Arata has similar elements and dates to the 21st century BCE, so that's 4,000 years ago. Myths that describe the origins of things are called etymological myths. Etymological myths which explain the multiplication of languages or the divine confusion of one original language, those myths are scattered all across human culture and history. The ancient Greeks attributed that mischief to Hermes. And the Wasania peoples of Kenya have a confusion of tongue story that arises from a great famine. The Naga tribes of India and Burma have such a story. The Aboriginal peoples of Australia and many tribes in Native tribes in Alaska and across the Americas have confusion of tongue stories or the story of an original language that is broken. The Estonian myth of the cooking of languages has some similar threads. The Islamic Quran and the Book of Mormon have references to the Tower of Babel itself. Irish folklore has a kind of Babel in reverse story in which the legendary king Phineas Farsa selected the best features of all the confused languages of the world and brought them together to create Gaelic. No wonder it's so incomprehensible. I'm sorry, it's a beautiful language. So as to why to look at this story, it's really simply that when we see an ancient mythic image or theme that echoes and echoes across cultures and through centuries, one that's taken up generation after generation, and that survives into the present day, still carrying potency, perhaps it's worth looking at what it means to us. Apparently, it reflects some primal sense of truth about ourselves or our character, our struggles, and so perhaps taking a look in that mirror will provide some insight. The second issue that I wanted to touch on with this story is the problem of interpretation. In particular, in the little bit of time we have, I would just ask the question, how are we to understand the character of God in this story? It does, after all, implicate the creator of the universe as responsible for a great measure of the conflict and divisions and lack of understanding between people and peoples. So if we were to take this as a sacred story, and it is, after all, in the scriptures of a large, very large portion of religious human beings, if you combine Jews and Christians and Muslims alone who hold this as a sacred story, it suggests that there's a holy or divinely given message contained in it. And yet I think any thinking person would be right to wonder, is this supposed to be a benevolent God? Thank you so very much for making it nearly impossible for human beings to understand each other and to get along together. Yes, thank you for taking a united humanity and dividing us into warring tribes. In a recent issue of The New Yorker, there was a cartoon that shows a woman and a dog in a park in the midst of a game of fetch. The woman is just about to throw the ball for the dog, and the dog is looking at her with some puzzlement and irritation, and there's a bubble over his head, and he's thinking, I'm starting to think you don't really want that ball. So in considering the story of the Tower of Babel, I find myself wanting to say to the character of God, I'm starting to think you really don't want human beings to be a successful species. Even those of us who are willing to give the benefit of the doubt to the biblical scripture, those of us who are making a good faith effort to be open-minded and open-hearted about the possibility that there is spiritual truth in these stories, are going to have trouble here. This story raises the ugly head of a persistent theological problem, which in the field of theology is called theodicy, the question of the nature of God in light of the reality of suffering and evil in the world. So how does one square the claim for a benevolent, all-knowing, and all-powerful God with the fact of rampant suffering and injustice? How do you hold together the God in the story of Babel with the God of forgiveness, compassion, reconciliation, and justice, who appears elsewhere in the Bible? Well, many Unitarian Universalists would easily resolve this dilemma by summarily tossing out the idea of God at the outset, an idea made all the more implausible by attributing characteristics such as omnipotence and omnibenevolence to the imaginary being. And additionally, myths like the Tower of Babel are easily diminished in significance by just understanding them as ignorant fabrications of primitive peoples trying to explain things they can't understand. So fair enough. But I'm going to bracket those easy solutions for the moment and look at this from another angle. The writer of the story of Babel had no intention of attributing the characteristics of love or compassion or eternal wisdom to Yahweh, the name that the writer actually uses in the story, which is usually translated into English as the Lord. Yahweh is a primitive God of a primitive people, a God who had to compete and hold up in the crowded pantheon of the ancient Semitic world with other warrior gods and sky gods. This was not really the God of Jesus. And the Bible is a quilt of stories drawn together over centuries from a multitude of sub-communities and cultures, each of which carries its impressions from the regional influences and the circumstances that were affecting those sub-communities. The biblical idea of God itself is a patchwork, and this character is coalesced from various sources and influences. It's a character that changes and evolves over centuries. So we have difficulty with it, particularly when we try to understand it as one seamless scripture describing one divine being. The author of the story of Babel is thought to be the writer that scholars call J, the Yahwist. J is considered the author of a number of particular episodes in the book of Genesis. And one of the themes in J's writing is protecting the boundary between the divine and the human realms. In the Garden of Eden, for example, by eating the forbidden fruit, man and woman may become like gods and are therefore banished from the garden, preventing them from retaining their immortality and achieving full divinity. In Genesis 6, the sexual union of the sons of God with human women, and this is, you know, very much of an ancient idea, are declared, this union is declared by Yahweh to be a violation of the necessary separation, and so limits are set on the lifespan of their offspring. And in the Tower of Babel story, Yahweh confuses human language in order to prevent humankind from achieving a divine-like stature. So paradoxically, J's Yahweh is a particularly anthropomorphic rendering. So even though there's this necessary separation that's upheld in these stories, it's because this is an especially anthropomorphic God. This Yahweh forms man from clay with his own hands, and he's fond of walks in the Edenic garden in the cool of the evening, and he makes clothes for his Adam and his Eve from animal pelts, and he speaks face to face with human beings. In other words, this is a very human God, subject to needs and fears and jealousies. He's vulnerable to the intense drives of his creations, these wily human beings with all their fierce curiosity and ambitions. Yahweh creates humanity in the divine likeness, perhaps because he longed for companionship, or he longed to be worshipped by sentient beings. And then Yahweh seems to panic every time we express the longings for knowledge or power or self-determination or immortality that are inherent in the very nature we were given, lest we storm the gates of heaven and take over. So without throwing out the whole vast and evolving idea of God itself or the possibility of something beyond us, and a large spectrum of that is captured across the span of what is the Bible. So if we, without throwing all of that away, we can understand that human beings are always trying to understand divine things from within the framework of their own location in history and culture and time. And so the Yahweh that we meet in this story is the Yahweh of this writer who is speaking for his own community and concerns. The other issue for us to consider today is what the story says to us in its just sort of at face value. Perhaps in the context of the story, the character of God was wise and correct to make it impossible for human beings to accomplish their vision. Now, I think about the current push to parcel up the moon to speculators so that human beings might mine for minerals or build futuristic resorts or erect vast billboards that might be seen from the earth. Can you imagine anything more grotesque? And yet, this is what unleashed, unmitigated ambition leads to. We do it because we can. Here is an actual advertisement. It's true, you too can become a lunar landowner by purchasing acres of land on the moon. The Lunar Embassy has been selling land on the moon for the past 22 years. They are the first and only company in the world to possess a legal basis and copyright for the sale of lunar and other extraterrestrial property within the confines of our solar system. What could be more unique than giving someone an acre on the moon? For the average person, an acre on the moon is an excellent gift and a great conversation piece. But many, corporations, such as the Marriott, have purchased thousands of acres on the moon for investment purposes, lunar exploration, and future development. That's the Tower of Babel before the confusion of languages. You know, that's sort of what I imagine. What, you know, if that story went on without its written outcome. So one moral lesson in the story is humility and recognizing our rightful place, our healthy place in the family of life. Because in spite of those primordial human beings being able to speak a single language, they threw that capacity into building not human well-being, but a vanity project, making a name for ourselves, as the scripture says. But the story leaves us with a very sad outcome for human beings as they become scattered across the earth and fragmented into tribes who do not understand each other. And this is the second legacy, so to speak, of the time of Babel. This is where our practice in Unitarian Universalist community can be a healing gift, the practice of listening across difference, of embracing the richness and depth of wisdom and the possibility that can come out of many voices, many languages, many visions woven together. But we are also a tribe. And it's absolutely natural for people to want to find safety in their tribe and to stay there, to just hang out there with their tribe. As we heard in Peter Morales's plea, we have a hard time bridging the gap between our ideal of multicultural unity and multiracial unity and class unity and our reality, which remains, we remain a denomination of white, Eurocentric, and middle-class people for the most part. So how do we learn to cross those difficult borders? And I'll just remind us of what he said in the last couple of minutes we have here, that we need the experience of doing it. So talking about it is great, but it's just the first step. And the most powerful practice is to get ourselves out where we actually are in relationship with people who are different from who are different religiously, different culturally, different racially, different economically than what is sort of the demographic of our congregation. Active is better than passive. So yes, there's being a tourist. There's the generous gift of fundraising that we do in this congregation. But that's not the same thing as active partnering. And so we need to learn how to do that. We need to do it together. Learn together. And as a congregation, we have many people in the congregation who do justice work or do service work. But as a community, Theodore Parker Church doesn't have this practice together. So it's just something to explore. Are there ways that the congregation can be side by side in this exploration? And then beginning at home, in our own neighborhood, in our own city of Boston. We don't have to travel to other countries to do so. And then as we reach across these borders, what is the basic human language that we need to know? I think we touched on it in our chalice lighting. I offer you peace. I offer you love. I offer you friendship. I see your beauty. I hear your need. I feel your feelings. My wisdom flows from a higher source, and I salute that source in you. Let us work together for unity and peace. So even without language, just leave you with a quote from Margaret Fuller. She wrote once to her Unitarian father. Margaret Fuller was a transcendentalist, a contemporary of Theodore Parker's. And she wrote to her father, who was a Unitarian. This was in the mid-19th century. "Your reluctance to go among strangers cannot too soon be overcome. And the way to overcome it is not to remain at home, but to go among them and resolve to deserve and obtain the love and esteem of those who have never before known you. With them, you have a fair opportunity to begin the world anew." May it be so. Let's sing together our closing hymn.